So I'm Peter Dalhouse, and I'm a Principal Research Fellow at CERDI, Centre for E-Research and Digital Innovation at Federation University Australia. And my background is geology, so I'm a geologist who works in soil and groundwater mostly, and I've spent a long time, about 40 years or more, in that field, and so I've collected a lot of data and I know a lot of things, and it's my mission really to liberate this data for people to use. And so we work with a group of technical people, very clever programmers and others who can do this and essentially bring data that's been collected over a very long period of time to people so that it can be used for decisions, really, and decision support.
So, yes, how does a geologist get into data management?
Well, it's interesting in that geology is all about data. You know, it's spatial data, typically. Not always. I mean, there are some bits of chemistry data about a particular rock or something, but largely it's about spatial data in three dimensions, which makes it quite interesting in itself because it's not just the surface of the Earth, but what's underneath the Earth as well. So groundwater is a good example of that. It's my field. And so, you know, there are not just sort of, it's not just that the Earth is saturated beneath our feet, which it is, but it's also that it has different aquifers at different levels and so on. So it's a complicated business. And the only way you can actually work this out, because you can't stick your head in the ground to look at it, is that you need data. And so data has been, you know, the key to understanding how the Earth works in all cases.
And CERDI, the Centre for E-Research and Digital Innovation, what does it do?
So essentially, it's an interesting question. I mean, what it does is it marries together research expertise. So people that have research expertise, they're the domain experts. So people that have expertise in geology or ecology or environmental management or psychology or sports and so on, everyone uses data. And so it's a way, e-research by definition, is using the internet to improve traditional research or create new forms of research. So anyone doing any research at all, or any investigation in fact, step one is always get your data together. Always, you know. So if you're an economist or you're a sports scientist or you're a geologist or whatever you might be, step one is get your data together. So that data typically is in disparate places, on disparate systems, in disparate formats. And so what we try and do is make that easier. Step two then is to actually sort that data out, harmonise it, synthesise it, you know, work out the error bars, throw some data away, keep some data and so on, because that's the data set you're then going to use to make decisions like modelling or you know, just visualisation or something. So if we can make this easy through using the internet, it actually creates a situation where it makes research easier and it saves people time and money and effort and all those sorts of things, but also brings together, you know, all the data that exists, if it can, about a particular project or a particular problem that you're trying to solve to get that decision. So it'll be, your decision will be based on the best possible data sets that there are.
And how is the data landscape changing? I mean, it's often said that we're in this era of big data. What does that actually mean?
So essentially, when I started in geology, it was at a period where data was just being translated from hard copy onto mainframe computers. And for a period in the 1980s, I worked in the public service. And at that stage, the government was the repository of data. And the government was also the collector of data at that time. And all that data was just being moved onto mainframe computers. So typically, you had a public service that collected data itself. So we had a drilling branch. There were soil scientists that collected data, you know, and a lot of the services that we had were still in the public's sector. So we had things like the SEC, or the, should I say, the energy, you know, the electricity commission, the gas and fuel, the railways, the ports and harbours, Qantas, Telstra, you know, all these were in the public sector still, and they all collected data as well for themselves. Then after the 1987 crash, the stock market crash, the world kind of adopted economic liberalism. And so we started selling off a lot of these facilities. So we started selling off things like the power supply or the railways or ports and harbours or those things. And with that, we sold off data and we lost data. So the public service and the government has got smaller and smaller and smaller through this time. And so in the public sector, there's a lot less data than there used to be. At exactly the same time as we've had the big data revolution, where we're collecting more data than we've ever collected on Earth, most of it by sensors. So most of this data is being collected from sensors like mobile phones, like you know, satellite sensors, like drones, handheld sensors, all sorts of sensor technologies now with the Internet of Things and so on, collecting massive amounts of data, but all of this data is in the private domain. So the idea really is to try and get these two together. So when people talk about big data, it's a complex thing because actually it's lots of little data and lots of little data that's held in different places, all in different places. Some of it's government data that's open data, freely available, but most of it is now data that sits elsewhere owned by someone else who may or may not choose to share that data.
Fascinating. So I love the idea that it's lots of little data, because I hadn't thought about that before, that it's actually not the volume so much. Well, it's partly the volume, but it's also the way that it's disparate.
Yes. So some data sets are massive by nature. Satellite data sets, time series data sets that are collected by sensors, might be air quality or groundwater levels or things like that. There are some data sets like Twitter or Facebook social data sets that may be very large as well. But a lot of data sets just collected, like soil data, for example, might only be collected once a year in the paddock by the farmer, but terribly important data. And if you marry that by all the farmers in Australia and all the paddocks and all the data that's being collected, and if you could put all that together, now that would be a big data set, but it's actually made up of small pieces of data, you know, that are being collected.
So is the argument for data democracy about the public good?
So you know, what is data democracy? So data democracy is, in my view, it's just one of the regimes, you know. So you have things like a data dictatorship. And a data dictatorship is where I have data and I use it for my own benefit, or I may use it against you in that data. But essentially, I'm not going to share this data because it's powerful to have this data for me. You might have a data aristocracy. You know, I've got this data. I'm happy to share it with you, but you need to buy my software, or you need to have me explain it to you, employ me to explain it to you and so on. So I've still got the power with that data. It might be a data oligarchy where you've got you know, a group of people that own some data who choose who to share the data with or not to share the data with and so on. Data anarchy is probably the most common of the regimes, where I'll give you the data. It's not my data, but I'll slip it to you anyway, and you can use it, and you'll take a piece of that and add it to another piece and create a new data set which you'll give to someone else, and so you end up with this world of messy data and ownership and so on. And that's the most common. And a data democracy then is this sort of ideal that we'd like to get to, where we've all got timely and equitable access to the data. Doesn't mean the data's free, Doesn't mean the data's open, because you might choose to share your data subject to some rules, or you might only choose to share the parts of your data that are not so confidential that you feel comfortable with, sort of thing. So it's still your data, you set the rules, but at least it's available, you're making it available for others under those rules, and so everyone has equitable and fair access and timely access to all the data that you need for whatever it is that you're trying to resolve.
And you said it's an ideal, so we're not there yet.
No, absolutely not. No. So one of the difficulties with it is that in some cases there's data that's freely available, even though the owner of the data doesn't quite understand that it is. And that happens through, you know, when you click I agree. So you're subscribing to Twitter or something, and at some point you click I agree, and it tells you that, it tells Twitter that, you know, you've agreed to share that data. Now, the value case in that for you is that you've chosen that Twitter, being on Twitter, is more important than losing control of that data. I mean, you don't really care about the fact that, you know, you just want to get on Twitter. And so you're happy to put up with that case. In other cases, people judge that their data is more important for them to keep control of. So examples of that are things like real estate data or data around, usually around some kind of business, commercial value to the data. And a lot of consultants in the world, they regard data as their power. So they're not really prepared to share that data at the moment anyway, because they feel they're going to lose something. So we're not there with data democracy.
When we talk about data, it's just struck me that we're talking about sort of this social media data that's held by consultants. What does it look like? What sort of information are we talking about?
So data, it comes in various forms. So there's data that comes from an idea with spatial data, I should say, you know, so mostly with spatial data. So there's data that is just an XYZ. So it's a place on Earth that has a value, you know, it's collected, a soil test or something like that might have several Zs. So, you know, but you've got a data that belongs to a point on the landscape. You've also got data that belongs to an area on the landscape. So satellite imagery, aerial photography, those sorts of things. You've also got data that's modelled, data that's regarded as fact. So you might have a groundwater level is a fact, but then you might model the groundwater surface. So you've got interpolated data in there as well. And so you've got a variety of different forms of data. You've got time series data, where you've got data collected over periods of time. But effectively, the thing that all shares in common is that it's bits and bytes. It's digital, you know, it's ones and zeros. And or if it's not, it can be made into ones and zeros. So essentially we've got, you know, really a series of data. We've got legacy data, so all the stuff that's been collected beforehand, really important stuff, particularly in things that don't change much, like geology, for example. You know, we've got data that's crowdsourced data or community collected data, so data that is collected by citizens, whether they realise or not, but they're collecting data. You know, we've got data that's collected through sensors and sensor technologies. And it's being streamed and beamed down to Earth all the time. We've got data that's being collected by researchers and by investigators and other people quite deliberately to look at a particular bit, you know. So you've got whole varieties of different data sources, and within that, whole varieties of different styles or types of data.
So one of the things that you do is sort of bring this data together in ways, so sort of make sure that you can compare it in a meaningful way, isn't it? So there's a lot of processing that goes around trying to make it all look the same, or that we can see it on a map or something
like
that.
It's some of the things that people really worry about with data is its quality, data quality, you know, because everyone wants the best data possible. But I'm one of those, so there are two kinds of scientists, right? There's a spectrum. There's people at one end, and that's my end, where I think all data's good. You know, just show it to me, I'll make my mind up whether it's good or not. And at the other end, you have scientists and data people who say, I'm not going to give you this and because it's not right or it's not correct or I don't trust it. It has to be perfectly correct. And I need to know what you're going to do with it, sort of thing. So there's sort of a restriction on that. But for me, I'm one of those who fall into that camp where I think all data is good, as long as I know what the error bars are around that data. So if the data's been collected in a way that's, for example, yield data, crop yield data, for example, may or may not be calibrated. Now, you know, I'll take both forms, whether it's absolute data or relative data, I'll still take that data, and I'll make my mind up myself as to how to use that. But I need to know at the start what the error bars are around that data.
I thought it might be handy, given that we've got a lot of other content on CERTI projects, if we could use some of the CERTI projects as a case study in why it's really interesting to be working with data in this way, or why data democracy is, how it relates to data democracy.
The soil health knowledge base is the one where we're getting closest to it, because within the soil health knowledge base, we're combining those sets of data, the legacy data, the sensor data, the model data, you know, the citizen or community contributed data in there. And it's also one where at the moment with digital agriculture and so on, there's a lot of effort being put into this idea of how do we get the private data and the public data together. So the thing about the private data and the public data, there was this wonderful paper published in Agricultural Systems recently by a group of researchers that looked at it from around the world. And it's this problem of you know, smaller governments and changes to public and private ownership is not unique to Australia. It's universal. Well, in Western countries anyway, it's universal. And so the idea of trying to get the private data and the public data together is really important. And it's in agriculture in particular, it seems to be a bigger question, because the decisions that you want to make for both the private decision makers and the public decision makers need the best possible data sets you can get. But also in agriculture, there's more data being collected now than ever. You know, satellite imagery is being collected so you can look at crop types and how much is planted in Russia or Ukraine or Australia or all those sort of places. So that can feed into your decision. But there's also data that's collected from every tractor, from every header, you know, from every spray boom. There's data that's collected. There's weather data that's collected by others, Bureau of Meteorology and so on. There's data as the produce reaches outside the farm gate to the abattoir or to the grain silo or to the mango clearinghouse or whatever it may be. You know, there's data collected all the way along the way. And so there's real keen interest for people to want to get this data. But the vast majority of that data, it lies in private hands. So in this area, there's been a lot of work being done around data cooperatives and trying to understand how you bring this data together. The thing I like about the soil health knowledge base is that it contains three components. One is an e-library, so you've got not just spatial data, but you've got all the text data, you know, the documents, the web pages, the videos, the podcasts, images, you know, anything at all can be plonked in there, and you can look for those. And then you've got the spatial data, so the stuff on the web map, which is terrific. But then there's also a third component we've added just recently, where it allows people to download that data, because a lot of people want that data for their own purposes. And so we've developed this. So the idea is, particularly in data democracy, the idea is to expose the data in as many places as you can. So, you know, we never take data from people. It's not our data. This is your data. But it's great if we can expose that data in as many places as possible.
How does it relate to the open data policies that have been implemented by the Australian government?
It's interesting. When you Google data democracy or look for data democracy, there's a lot of literature around how data makes a more democratic society. So it's a different concept to the data regime concept that I was talking about. So there's a lot of work being done by people who are looking at whether open data, making government data open, is creating a more democratic and fairer society. And I think that's what's really driving a lot of the desire for governments to open up their data sets, because people are feeling otherwise that they might have something to hide. You know, so I think that's part of it. And I think it's also true that for governments, they're saying, look, you know, we don't really know how people are going to use this data, so we can't second guess every possible use, so we'll just put it out there and let people hopefully use it in ways that's going to create jobs and growth or development or whatever it is that they want, you know, in there sort of thing. And so, you know, open data is good, but the problem with open data really is that you're only looking at a fraction of the data that exists, because there's so much data that's in the private sector. You know, whereas open data, you know, a good example would be, for example, the soils data. Now, you know, we have a relationship with Precision Ag, who just one service provider. Last year, they collected 42,000 soil tests. You know, I don't know what proportion that would be of the government data set, but it's probably about a third of the existing government data set for all time. So quite quickly, you're going to end up in a position where you're getting more and more data in the public sector, in the private sector rather, so more and more data in the private sector than you'll have in the public sector. In fact, in most cases, that's already true. So even though you've got open data, and open data is fantastic, and I love it. I think it's just fantastic to have open data. Really, we appreciate it a great deal, but it is only a fraction of the data that exists.
So what are the challenges in bringing, in moving towards a more sort of democratic framework?
So one of the biggest challenges is to overcome, so I'll go back to that thing, you know, how do I get private data? How do I get people who own data to want to expose that data in a way that others can use it? So one of the difficulties, one of the barriers to that is that people feel that it might somehow be a disbenefit to them if they do that. There might be something that they'll lose in doing that. So it's a case of then creating the reason why you would want to do that. You know, why? So when I go to you and say, can I have a look at your data, please? You're going to say, well, why would I bother? You know, what's the point? What's in it for me? So there has to be a value proposition for people to want to do it. Now, in the case of something like Twitter, you hit I agree, because that value proposition of using Twitter is so great that you don't even think about what people are going to do with the data. Whereas in other cases, if I said to you, can I have a look at the data on your bank balance or something, then people are going to say, I'm not so sure about that. And that's fair enough. You know, I don't think that's a fair ask in that sense. So there's probably always going to be some data. But if I said, you know, is it okay if I could use the data in your bank balance as a general sort of look at modelling economic zones for Ballarat or economic zones for Victoria or something, in a way that completely de-identifies you, but I just want to use that data for a purpose that's in the public interest, you're probably going to say, yeah, that's okay, provided you give me an ironclad guarantee that no one's going to misuse that. Oh, I'd be happy with that. And so therein lies that challenge. How do we actually give people the confidence to want to do that? Soil tests are a great example where, you know, to show soil tests paddock by paddock is not such a good idea, because that reflects, I mean, for the public to see that is not such a good idea, because that may reflect on you as a farmer. It may, you know, increase or decrease the value of your property. It might have all sorts of things. So for me to say to you, give me your soil test data, but, you know, so let me start that again. So I'll say, okay. So I go to you and say, give me your soil test data. And you say, well, no, you'd rather not, because it may, you know, if everyone gets to see that, it reflects on me as a farmer, you know, it may be that the bank might devalue my property or something or other. But if I said, okay, give me your soil data, and I'll show you things about your farm that you never thought about, and this is essentially what we're doing, then you're interested. But only you can see that. The world can't see that. But at the same time, I'd like to use that soil data to create better digital soil maps or better information for the general public to see in the public good. They won't know it's your data, but I just want to collect that data in a pool of data to create a better overall product that I model. You'll say, oh, it's okay. There's no problem there. That's the kind of thing that's, it's creating that value case. It's creating the value proposition that allows people the confidence to collect it. It's a hard task. It's a really hard task. And, you know, it's the sort of stuff that Paul's been working on a fair bit in, you know.
Yeah. I'm wondering, are there real risks in sharing your data?
I guess there are real risks in sharing your data, in a sense, only if it's misused, only if it's... So the risk in sharing your data comes from the way that it's then allowed to be used in the public arena. So, for example, you know, to go back to that example of soil data, if you could see all the soil data in everyone's paddocks, you know, real estate agents and banks would be right onto that, you know. If you could see all of the, you know, the water distribution network, that may be of interest to terrorists or others, you know. If you could see certain data, yeah, certain data could be misused because there are devious people out there who want to use it for, you know, who want to use it in a way that's not in the public good. I guess there are risks in sharing data. So the idea is to try not to, to try and think of those and to maintain confidentiality and to maintain privacy and so on, but be able to use all the data for the public good.
So we come back to that concept a lot, the public good. So what do you see are the benefits of this sharing?
Well, the benefits are huge, because we're in a position where, for example, to make a decision about land use, to make a decision about environmental conservation or preservation, to make a decision about schools or hospitals or any of those things that are in the public good and in the public domain, we need to have the best data sets we possibly can. You know, a good example at the moment is the state of the environment. You know, so what is the state of the environment? Is it improving, or, you know, is it being run down, for example? Well, the only way to know that is to have all of the data that you could possibly have. And so, you know, there are real benefits in the public good for putting all those data sets together to do that. Now, you want to be able to do that in a way that people are quite happy to be able to contribute their data for that to happen, but without losing any benefit themselves. And that's really important. Unless you can do that effectively, data democracy won't work.
I'm thinking again about the case studies, and I'm wondering if maybe Sport and Recreation Spatial illustrates some of those, because it's private providers using information and deciding to share that with others, but they're making very clear decisions, aren't they, about what they share and what they don't. And they're getting benefits the researchers and the research community and the government community is getting benefits too.
Yeah, so sport and recreation spatial is not something I know a lot about. It's not my project. You'd have to ask Rochelle, really. But my understanding is that you're getting collections of data from private sources, and it is being used for the public good in terms of deciding where sports facilities should be, or you know, the economic situation or health situation around sports and so on, you know. So yeah, it could be a possibility. It's the sort of thing where I guess there would be a lot of companies who would like to see that data as well, because they might be interested in simple things like selling footballs or tennis rackets or clothing or whatever the case might be to people. But there could also be companies that are looking to develop particular facilities and so on, you know. So I don't know. Interesting to know the disbenefits of that, of sharing that. I know membership is one of them. You know, it's a bit like the grower groups in agriculture. You know, they're happy to share data provided that it doesn't retract from their membership, because that would be, why would you be a member of a grower group if everyone had the same access to the data? So you want to be able, I understand that, you want to be able to protect people in their data.
And organisations.
Yeah.
So then what's the benefit of something like online farm trials where grower groups are sharing field data?
So online farm trials is a good example where the data belongs to the grower group, but they set the rules, you know. So they choose which parts of the data to expose. They might choose to expose that data after a certain embargo period so that their members get access to it first. You know, they may choose not to display certain trials because they don't have confidence in the results or something. It's your data, you set the rules. Dead simple.
So then what are the benefits of them sharing that data?
The benefits really are in terms of what they can understand about growing grain in their patch from the experiences of people growing grain in similar situations in other patches. And so growers in Western Australia may have the same kind of conditions and soils by and large as the growers in Western Australia South Australia or places like that. You know, the high rainfall zone growers have a different scenario, but they like to see what's happening with other high rainfall zones around Australia, you know. So it's really a matter of sharing data to improve your own business and, you know, the dollars in your wallet, really.
So what about something like the NRM planning portal, where it's community groups putting data in that they have collected and monitored, isn't it? So maybe talk us through that project.
So the NRM planning portal is a tough one. And the reason being is it's you're working with volunteers. So a lot of the data through Landcare, you know, so you're working with volunteers through Landcare. So a lot of the data that's being collected is actually quite messy data. And so you've got situations where data's been collected on different systems at different times. Some of it's, you know, it's always collected by volunteer people, so some of it's collected in a way that's not always consistent because of the turnover of committee members and others that, you know, may be collecting that data, the turnover in, you know, coordinators, land care coordinators and so on. So you end up with this nice, messy collection of data that has a legacy where people don't really remember a lot of that legacy. So, you know, some of that data was collected by old Joe, you know, but he's moved on or he's moved down the coast or whatever the case might be. And I don't really remember that project or something. So it's been quite an experience for us to get that data together out of the community. The data, nevertheless, is really, really important. It's important just from the point of view of being able to look at what's been done in a catchment, because that data is not necessarily collected by the government or by others. Even though they're paying the money, So, you know, they're paying the money, but they don't really know what that money's bought unless this data is recorded by the community groups themselves. And this is becoming really important, I think. But also tells us, for the groups, where the next project should be based. So if you've done, you know, 3 kilometres along the Lee River here and 5 kilometres there, in between, you could then say, well, these are the areas we've got to target. You know, you could go and knock on doors to try and encourage people into that. But also it gives you an idea of, you know, you could be proud of the fact that over the 30 years of land care, you've achieved so much out of all of this. So there's a whole series of rewards for the volunteers in being able to see this data. There's rewards for the government in being able to see where the money's been spent and so on. And there's also rewards in terms of both the catchment managers and land care groups to be able to plan what should be done next, you know, in terms of where the gaps are in all of that.
Who owns the data in the context of...
Well, it's owned by the data custodians. All our data is owned by the data custodians. So the data custodians, in that case, are land care groups.
What about VVG?
The first groundwater database was set up in 1969 when the Groundwater Act was introduced. There was a single centralised database on a mainframe computer in the Geological Survey. Then in 1988... there was machinery of government changes, they're called, and the database was split. Some of the data went to other government departments. Meanwhile, separate databases had sprung up in some of the water authorities, the State Rivers and Water Supply Commission at the time, the Soil Conservation Authority had separate databases. So by 1988, there was about 4 different groundwater databases. Now there's at least 8, perhaps 9, groundwater databases that are within government departments. So you can't say the situation's getting better. It's getting worse, in fact. And so the idea of federating all of this data is really important, because if you want to make a decision about groundwater and groundwater management, and groundwater is a very precious resource, and because we can't see it, the only access we have is through data to that, then, you know, you need to bring these data sets together into a common place. Now, a lot of the government departments will show you their data, but they won't show other government departments' data, which is, you know, just the way it works. So it's you know, the VVG has really become important because it's the only place you can go where you can see all of this data brought together conveniently in one place. And it gets use, quite a lot of use. So we're up around, you know, 500 or 600 hits a day on that website constantly. It's constant use, weekday use. So we know it's industry and water authorities and so on that are using it. And from that, we've learnt what people would like to have out of that data too. So the next version of the VVG will be improved and better and so on. But it's a good example of the fact that most of that data still is in the public domain. There's very little private data we're showing on the VVG, but even within the public sector, through machinery of government changes and the whole history of it, you know, we're fragmenting data and fragmenting databases all the time.
I suppose you just don't think about the, you know, it's just not high on the priority list when you're restructuring an organisation, or it gets sold or it gets moved on. Yeah. You don't, it's not top of mind, is it? What's going to happen to the data?
It's not, but it should be. I mean, I think there are unintended consequences of, you know, economic liberalist policies that have been introduced. And one of those things that's suffered is the fact that the governments are no longer in a position where they understand everything that's going on because of the fact that they've lost quite a lot of that data, those data. mean, the SEC used to drill, every power pylon in Victoria. They'd do an investigation for that. Wonderful, wonderful collection of data. You know, it's essentially lost, in the scheme of things, because, that's just all been gone. All of the, if you talk to my colleagues that deal with the Latrobe Valley coal mines, there was so much data being collected by the SEC around those Latrobe Valley coal mines, but it's just really difficult to get hold of. It's lost, forgotten, ignored. When the State Rivers and Water Supply Commission became effectively the Rural Water Corporations now, a lot of the data that existed has disappeared somewhere. We have lists of reports and investigations that have been done, but we no longer can find those reports. So if they exist, they've also gone to the private companies, or they've just been thrown away. I'm not sure. We can't find them. We've had quite a good hunt for them.
That's actually pretty serious.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think it is. Because, a lot of that data is terribly important. Some of the best data we've got for Ballarat was collected in 1870 and 1880, when geologists could access the mines underneath the city and map those mines. So even though the data may be, over 100 years old, it's still very, very valuable data. I mean, putting a value on data is such a hard thing. And this is Paul's area of expertise, really, rather than mine. But how do you value data? If someone takes a groundwater reading in 1870 and no one looks at it for 150 years, during that time, people would say, well, that data was valueless. But 150 years later, someone's looked at that, and with that one reading, they've been able to discover that, groundwater levels have gone up or down or the same or, whatever the case may be. Then that data has real value, even though it's been ignored for such a long time. So how do you actually value data? How do you put a value on data? It's such a hard thing. And so for governments who, for example, the state government has decommissioned a number of groundwater monitoring boards recently. And the problem lies in the fact that it's very difficult to explain to politicians and government departments why you need to collect data. Because the value case for doing that is very difficult. We collect all this data, but what are people doing with it? Show me what people are doing with it. Well, we can't show that so easily, because the data may not be used for another 20, 50, 100 years, at which time it may be the most valuable data set that you could possibly imagine. So it's quite a difficult task to put a value on data.
So what would you like to see implemented in the policy area?
Well, I guess, so there are two things. One is that it comes back to sticks and carrots in terms of data democracy. How do you get people to want to contribute their data? So one of the ways you could say get people to contribute is say, all right, if I'm going to give you public funds to do something, then I would like to see the data returned back. And so this happens a little bit more now, but I think that's one lever that governments have to be able to do things. So if you're getting funding to do a piece of work to look at soil improvement or to look at groundwater or to look at sports or whatever it may be, then we require some of that data to flow back. And the other one is really to encourage people through incentives to provide their data, their private data. So if you've got incentives for people to provide their data in some way, then I think that'd be two possibilities to improve data democracy through the public sector, but otherwise I can't think of too much, to be honest.
Absolutely.
I mean, there are a lot of websites where people say things like, you know, we'll create a website and people put their data there. So there's Data Linker in New Zealand. There's, you know, Data Farmer that Birchip, you know. So there are websites where people have created these websites that say, you know, here's a place where you can put your data. But why would you? You know, why would you? I mean, you've been sitting on a tractor all day. Last thing you want to do at night is go home and load data into a system. For what purpose? And so there has to be an incentive for people to do it.
And there has to be incentive for the sort of single private data collector and the private corporation, and also for government, isn't it?
And community. And citizen scientists, yeah, and community groups and so on. Now, often with community groups, the incentive is just the sheer pleasure of having seen a powerful owl or, you know, long-footed potoroo or something and taken a photo of it and been able to put it on a website and say, this is wonderful stuff, you know. So there's a lot of biodiversity kind of data, rare and threatened species. The SWIFT website's an excellent example where people do like to post their photos and put stuff up. And I think that's terrific because there's some kind of pleasure that's just derived from the altruism or from just the sheer joy of almost like a collector, you know, of being able to do this. And so with you know, the motivations within citizen science or within community monitoring are quite different, absolutely different, to the motivations from, say, the private sector where you're making money, like a farmer, or the motivation in corporations, or where it may be that you wanted to put data out there because it might be greenwashing or something or other, you know. Or there might be, you know, different motivations in terms of, you know, the public service or public areas. So the motivations are hugely variable. You know, in that.
So if data isn't top of mind and there's this danger that the data that's being collected isn't really being thought about and legacy data's not really being thought about, what would you like to say to the decision makers? What would you like them to think about?
I mean, I don't know whether the decision makers realise the importance of data. One would hope that they do, but maybe they don't. I don't know that. So I guess that's an exploration that would be needed. But the thing I've been saying to the sort of decision makers within the public service is don't for a minute think that you have all the data. You don't. You know, there are lots more data in the private sector, and unless you're actually looking at that, you're on a hiding. Because when you put out policies or you put out requirements for, you know, a good example is with NaturePrint, for example. You know, so NaturePrint is something where it's a map that shows the value of native vegetation in Victoria. And when you put out some of these instruments, you need to make sure that they're correct. So if you're producing a map of native vegetation for Victoria, and you're saying to people, here's the value of native vegetation in Victoria, it needs to be able to be tested at the property scale level. Because if you're putting out this map and someone looks at it and says, well, hang on a minute, you're saying this is rare and endangered, but I can show you in the paddock that it's a stand of Pinus radiata, then it doesn't pass the pub test. And the fact is people are starting to know more than the government, because people are collecting more data than the government, because in the public sector there's more data available than the government has. And a really good example of that was with the Hazelwood fires at the time, you know, where air quality was an issue, and people were buying monitors off the internet to check air quality, and where the government might be saying air quality is good, that people are saying, well, no, it's not, because, you know, everyone's now a sensor. Everyone's walking around as a citizen sensor in this case. And so, you know, the government needs to understand that they don't have all the data anymore as they used to, and that they need to embrace this idea of being able to encourage data democracy and really embrace data democracy, because if we're going to get public decision making and private decision making based on the best possible data sets, then the only way we can do that is if we have access to those data sets.
So partly it seems it's about the public sector being open to this sort of citizen sensor material. You know, how does it do that? How does it open itself to being more real-time or more responsive to what the crowd can tell it? Is that one of the challenges?
Yeah, so when you have sensor data, you need to be able to have that displayed in real time somewhere, and that would be wonderful. So if you had sensor data, for example, where you're collecting air quality sensors, if you had sensor data on a trams and buses, you know, if people were had wearable technologies where they were wearing sensors of some kind, and you could see that in real time, and you had real time air quality maps, then these sorts of things, I think, would be, you know, of great use. Then it comes down to, you know, whether you trust that data and so on. So there are issues around that need to be resolved and thought through. But I just think they're technological issues rather than, issues that are showstoppers. I don't think they're showstoppers. Yeah.
So whose role is it to work on integrating all of that and working through the technical issues? Whose job is it?
Well, when you're talking about data federation, the group that federate the data have to be trusted independent groups. So I think it's a wonderful role for universities, not just FedUni, but all universities. I think that's a great role for universities. I think people like CSIRO and Data 61. So we do have research institutions that are regarded fairly highly and are trusted by people to say, you know, if it's put out by CSIRO, then you're going to feel like it's probably okay. If it's put out by Melbourne Uni or Fed Uni, you know, University of Queensland or something, you think it's going to be pretty right, you know. And so I think that's the role for those groups who are federating those data sets. The government departments and the government agencies could do it, but they do sort of end up in these pigeonholes where they're only ever going to show their own data, and they're not terribly keen on showing citizen data or private data or, you know, other sets of data, because that there's statutory requirement, or it's not within their remit, or whatever the case might be, you know.
So, but surely there's a cost. There's a cost for a CSIRO or a FedUni to do all of that work of coordinating with the citizenry, with the private sector, with the government sector, and getting all the agreements with data custodians and making the data so that it can all be compared and aggregated. You know, that's a lot of work. So where's the benefit in the end of all of that work?
So a lot of this has already been done. So when you look at the NCRIS funding that's come out, the NCRIS funding has given us wonderful data federated data repositories or houses, or, you know, what do I call them? Portals. So the NCRIS funding has given us wonderful data portals that already federate data, like the Atlas of Living Australia, like the Terrestrial Ecosystems Research Network, or TERN. There's IMOS and so on. And we've also got the Australian National Data Service, which is this federation of university data, you know, they collect data together. So we already have infrastructure there. I don't think the problem lies in the technology so much as it lies in the social side of it, you know, the will to bring this data together and to do this. So there's already a nascent start to all of this stuff. you know, whether that can be improved and enhanced or continued through taxpayers' funders. So it depends on whether, I guess, the government and taxpayers are willing to fund this, whether they think data's good enough, you know. Whether it's worth it is the question. And I guess that's up to us to determine and to demonstrate the value case of why this data is important, why you would want to do it, why it's necessary. And I guess that's part of where CERTI research is going, you know, in that.
And what's your sense of the value of data?
Oh, it's, you know, we can never have enough is my feeling about data. I think, you know, data's, you know, to quote Adrian Turner from Data 61, data is the new oil, you know. I think, you know, it's, we can never have enough. And the reason why we can never have enough data, really, is because the next step, as I said right at the start, the first step is to get all your data together. Now, you can never have enough data to get together. The second step, then, is to sort this data out and to work through all this data. And the third step, then, is to model it and make decisions with it. Now, all of this will become seamless through artificial intelligence and machine learning. And so it requires data to do this. So in order to be able to work out, you know, what data to select and what models to apply and so on, yeah, sure, all that has to require research and, you know, clever people in universities and CSIRO and other places to do that. But eventually, for the consumer of that data, for the decision maker at the other end, the end user of that data, it'll be essentially worked out for them on the fly. And so as more and more data is being collected, every time you ask that question, what do I plant this year, or how deep do I need to drill, or those sorts of questions, the system will just, through its artificial intelligence, work that out for you using the most current, most up-to-date, most useful data that there is. I guess for a lot of people, they think that the problem is that you've got all of these disparate data sets and they're owned by all these different people and so on. How do we bring that together? Oh, it's just impossible, it's too hard. And in recent discussions with farmers, there are really good examples where they're saying, well, they, you know, if they've got a John Deere tractor, you know, they can't see that data on their, together with the data off their case header or something. So different brand names, different data, disparate data sets are actually quite difficult for most people to imagine how you would put those together. But seriously, the technology has resolved that. There are really good examples with the, you know, through the work that's been done through Oren at Melbourne Uni, or the Atlas of Living Australia, work that's been done through NCRIS, and there's whole international teams that have worked together through the Open Geospatial Consortium in creating data standards and data schemas that bring even international data sets together. So the interoperability part of it, the ability to bring together data from different sources on different computer systems in different data formats, that's really been resolved. The question now is, how do you actually get the social will for people to want to do that? And that's turning into a social science issue or a social science problem that's a little bit harder to resolve, because you need to be able to work out what kind of levers people would like, what's the value case, what are the motivations, why would they want to do it, what are they frightened of, what are they happy with, all those sorts of things. And so bringing together the social landscape around data democracy has probably become more important than the technological landscape.
So even though we're making kind of quite extraordinary technological leaps in artificial intelligence and all that sort of thing, it still boils down to people.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, and in fact, in a lot of cases, to political will as well. You know, but I have to say that with the open government movement, the open data movement within governments all around the world, that open data movement within governments has actually resolved a lot of that at the government level. So the government's decided they want to make data open. Can we help other people decide that they would like to make their data open as well?